going to start with Just War. As London had asked last week, holding that off because he told me after, right between Sunday School and church, they weren't going to be here this week. So I figured there was no sense in answering the question of the person who raised it who isn't going to be here. So we'll do that next week. That means we may move beyond Augustine a little bit, but we will retrack and get back to him some next week. I want to pick up where we left off. I started blathering a little bit about my ideas about sinful nature. I wanted to give you an opportunity to weigh in on that, ask questions, things like that. Remember, we are with Augustine, late 300s, and he's going to be the one that first gives us this notion of original sin.
It always seemed to be one of these. I was either born with sin, or as soon as I had my first opportunity, I chose it for myself anyway. And so I'm just curious of why this became such a huge debate.
Part of the idea was trying to figure out the idea just that theologically that all of humanity is guilty before God. On what basis do we establish that guilt? It's kind of what is really behind all of this. And so the simplest way is to rewind the clock to, within the first minutes or years or weeks, whatever it is back then, and say, it happened then, we were all present in some way, and therefore we are all guilty, just as Adam was guilty. Therefore, you don't have to worry about people running around claiming to be righteous. You don't have to get into that argument at all. And there are clearly people doing that. I mean, Jesus himself is dealing with someone who says, all of these commands I have kept. So there are people who think that their standing with God is right. Paul would even say things like, would have said things like that about himself. If all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, in what way have all sinned? I'm not going to argue that you really are a very rotten liar. I'm just going to make the case that from get-go, we started off in the ditch, and therefore, however good you were from then on, you're really rotten. That was more or less what was back there.
The concept of original sin, is that present everywhere?
That's a good question. Off the top of my head, I am not aware that it is. Part of some of this is, this is why we have to kind of take, we give Augustine some respect, but we have to also say, all right, this guy wasn't Jesus, A, and B, with the life that he lived, he was a little messed up about some things. And so he tends to tie a lot of things to sexuality and to the act of sex, actually, not one's proclivity or orientation, but actually the act. So for him, there's what's called conduciism. So this is less than an interesting thing to non-theologians, I'm willing to say that. But I mean, the question is, how does the human soul get into the human body? And the two main ideas are that every time that a person is conceived, God essentially gets his hands dirty in the creation of another soul. That was one idea. Another idea is, and this is where Augustine would have gone, that it isn't a new soul every time, that God actually got his hands dirty once. Well, maybe he got it twice, but the first couple, there's a soul created there. And then everything else is almost like biological DNA from there. And so the reason you get sinful nature is because your sin has been mutated, your soul, sorry, has been mutated by sin, and therefore every subsequent soul that comes from that will have that same distortion. Can't help but to. So because because of that need to talk about human souls, and that would have not have been a Jewish notion at all. That's a very Greek philosophical notion. For the Jew, for the Hebrew, the person is an entire person. There is no idea in ancient Hebrew of a disembodied soul. The word in Hebrew is nephesh. You are a nephesh. You don't have a nephesh. You have this living breath. You don't. You are it. You don't have it. So for them, a notion of this kind of a third of who you are that was twisted by something, that would have been a foreign concept. Not that they wouldn't have said that somehow Adam and Eve had an effect on everyone, but certainly it wasn't necessarily like an evolutionary mutation of DNA somehow.
The Eastern Orthodox disagreed with the Augustine, right, on this issue. And so what is their perspective on sin and how it operates in the world?
It is actually, while we don't get the firm split between East and West, the Eastern Orthodox and the Roman Catholic Church, while that doesn't happen firm until 1054, if you look at their roots, this is where they really start to diverge, is the dependence on the gospel. So, yeah. Interestingly enough, the Eastern Orthodox Church has a radically different notion of sin. This is a place where we have to be careful not imposing our post-Reformation notions of sin on Augustine, too, though. So when we think of sin, most of us are thinking of, you have criminal guilt before God. There is a law that's been broken, and you're standing before God as guilty. Now, because God is nice, he's given you a really good defense attorney who's going to get you off, essentially, and that's Jesus. Very kind of juridical notions is a very typical Western way of thinking about sin, salvation, and the work of Jesus. In the East, they typically talk about sin as disease. So this is, you are sick, and he has come to heal you, which is really different than he has come to declare you righteous in some way. Now, it's not that they would reject that, but the predominant notion of sin in the Eastern Orthodox Church is one of disease and illness that must be somehow restored and healed rather than forensic guilt that somehow must be dealt with, positive or negative. There's going to be a scapegoat that's going to take the rap for you, and there has to be a guilty or not guilty verdict that comes down. So that would be a big way that they would be going different here. And it does come back to this notion of sin, that it's a radical different understanding of sin.
Would they speak of original disease?
I don't know. I would have to think that there's some, I don't know, to be honest with you. Correct, yeah. Yes. So I think, you know, do we all have the genetic marker that allows us to be more susceptible to the disease? They wouldn't be rushing out to say that we are automatically guilty because of this. We have been weakened from what we're supposed to be somehow because of this. I think there's something to be retained about Western post-Reformation understandings of it. I think there is a guilt and innocent stuff that we don't want to lose, but it isn't the only way to understand it. And if we have a broad understanding, I will greatly appreciate what he has done instead of simply change. But it has to be just let us know why. It's like all of these things. So I'd have to read more about that.
Trespass results in condemnation for all people. So it's not like the idea that Adam and sin somehow impinges upon us came from Augustine. So you're saying that, like, the phrase original sin and his sort of philosophical understanding of how that might have been transmitted to us was his sort of sort of unique take.
Right. Well, he, yes. So I'm not trying to suggest that Augustine's position is, does not have biblical support first. But yes. So my view of the fact that we have been affected by a sinful nature is another way to get that verse says yes to my position too. So for him, he is trying to make sure not just that we have been tainted, but that he would argue that we are guilty. That we stand guilty before God because of that thing. So, and where this really gets interesting then is, verses like, as in the first Adam all died, so in the second Adam what? So if we're going to take an Augustinian view that somehow there has been a forensic effect to everyone because of Adam, what possible forensic effect to everyone has there been because of Christ? Maybe none. But if you're saying yes to Augustine and follow his logic, then you have to interpret those verses in a similar kind of way. Well, what possible effect might there be to all of humanity? We'll get to some of the ways that could be understood.
That's where I have a difficulty with the concept of original sin, because if I cannot make the choice to follow Christ, and if I have to make that choice in order to be deceived, then it might be a limit to my logic, but I would then have to have made the choice to disobey in order to be guilty. Those two go together in my mind, and I can't separate them.
I'm in the camp with this. I always struggle in classes when I have to try to, and I try to be fair, but when I'm trying to defend kind of a hardcore 5-point Calvinism, because it's not my camp, and I want to do my best to give it a fair shake, but that's just not how I see it. It's hard to.
I was raised with this notion of being
in
accountability. So, as a person who loves kids, as both angels and demons, so where would you fall down on that?
The angel accountability? So, it's an extra-biblical idea, but it's a handy theological concept. And it does have some support implicit in Scripture. So, it will be tied to the idea of a bar mitzvah, for example. That there was this notion that there was a time when a young male child became a man. And that was actually celebrated by the community. So there are sort of hints of that we could say, okay, it's not, we can't find it in the Bible, but we can see hints of this occurring. It's one of the reasons that Calvinists are going to argue for the appropriateness of infant baptism, because it's a sign of the covenant, just like circumcision was. If circumcision claimed this child to be one of ours, one of the community, Calvinists of the Reformation are going to argue for the validity of infant baptism based on that. Because of the importance of covenant, this is a sign of the covenant, just like circumcision was. Well, they didn't wait until they were 13. Why did they have to wait for it? So, it's not in the Bible. We have to be very careful how quick we are to kind of default to it. But that isn't to say that there's kind of no support, either within the church or even within the scripture, that could be marshaled again for it, I guess, for the church.
There is one of the prophets who talks about before the child is old enough to choose the right or the wrong. I don't remember where that is, but it does state it almost exactly like that. That's part of my understanding.
Something in there where they did the census, and it was everybody that was 20 and older, so I don't know, yeah. Yeah, it kind of raises a question about why does it matter what we believe about original sin. We just think
almost all of life, with the possible exception of zeal and passion for the Lord, almost all of life is found in moderation. It's in the middle of the road, not on the beginning of the front of the road. Because, I mean, you have, even in the church's life, but throughout even human history, there's the mistake of pretending like age doesn't matter at all. And there were times in the church where they were ordaining infants. Then there's other times where it's like age matters completely and entirely. And sometimes even today's church is there, where we have to have church for the 15 to 17 and a half year old or something like that. Because, you know, well, if that's the case, then the only church I can go to is middle-aged, balding, overweight, like males. I mean, because that's the only kind of person that you're going to understand me. So how do we operate in a way that we realize that it matters, but it doesn't matter that much? We don't ignore the differences, but we don't say that everything is the differences. The church has fallen on both in both churches at different times. So part of some of this conversation, one of the things that Augustine was going to be kind of wrestling with, is Pelagianism. Pelagius is going to make the case, and I know my thought was spurred on by Bob's comment, but I know Bob, you weren't making this case, so I don't want to blame him, but in my mind, he's a fault. So. Pelagius basically said, forget this original sin stuff. People are basically good. Yes, there are people that are going to go to hell. There are people that sin all the time. But that's because of choices that they make. And a person can choose to follow God. Very quickly, the church had some real concerns about this because this all of a sudden, it is at least theoretically possible that someone wouldn't be Jesus. If someone made all of the right choices, then they wouldn't need Jesus. Now we know, statistically, the chances of that ever occurring are like, that it's theoretically possible that someone could. And that person then wouldn't need Jesus. So the church is then going to say, no, sorry, no thanks to that. So that's going to come down, innocent. Pope Innocent the First, in the 400s, sends a letter, 417 it is, telling some folks to quit teaching these things. The letter said, "We judge by the authority of apostolic power that Pelagius and Celestius be deprived of ecclesiastical communion until they return to the faith out of the snares of the devil." So they are essentially executing the idiot at this point. They're not condemned, they're not taken out of town and stoned, but you don't get to have communion until you come back to them in the bridge, more or less. Because they found that their positions are outside. But here's what's interesting, though. I mean, so most of us would say, yeah, there are problems there. I think a lot of us are going to be what's called semi-Augustinian or semi-Pelagian. Depending on the fundamental question, are people good fundamentally or bad fundamentally? Non-rhetorical question. This is good. This is fundamentally people are good. Okay. Are you voting or are you coming? Okay.
Interesting that, I mean, I go to public school, and you know, they had that conversation, and now we're having that conversation in Sunday school.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought that they did the comment on
that. And it is how we view people is kind of a really important thing. I assume everyone else is fundamentally bad. Since we have two or three.
I think it depends a little bit on your definitions, too. Because we all take our opportunities to be selfish. You know, it's terribly bad. Or we would all be murderers if we thought we could get away with it. I don't think we're that bad. So what do you mean by fundamentally bad? I think we can all be selfish. Everybody has a propensity to be selfish. So if you define that as fundamentally bad, then we're all fundamentally bad. But you'll be surprised, I mean, you can be surprised at some of the worst people who do something very selfless and very heroic to help somebody else, which is almost against everything you put to their nature. Okay, does that mean they're fundamentally good because they could do that? So I don't think it's one way or the other.
I think it's both. Because we were made fundamentally good, and we still have parts of God in us, and we are fallen, so that makes us a fallen fundamentally good. But we're now bent towards evil, so we're fundamentally good, made fundamentally good, but now bent towards evil. That's how I look at it.
I agree with that, and I think I've been thinking a lot about that spot in Genesis where the serpent says to Eve, did God really say that? And you weren't sure why. And I think, obviously, this is very true. I know it's very easy to see in young children, you know, in their eyes, they're sort of like, well, I'm surely getting in trouble. Or not. This is really bad. And we just kind of, you know, experiment with that. And so I think we're fundamentally weak, and we are going to, at some point, listen to the serpent. But we are made, we carry the amount of death, too.
Let's go around the table some more. I think it's also important when thinking of Augustine's view of original sin to also remember kind of his definition of sin, which I'm going to be brave and try to summarize here my understanding of the way I read it, which is essentially it is a sin to prefer the lesser good over the greater good. And the greatest good is God. So anytime you prefer anything other than God, you are sinning. So that's not really like a high bar of sin to like say, well, of course people are fundamentally never going to prefer anything other than the greatest good. Well, no, there actually are many cases in which everybody something other than the greatest good. So, in that sense, I think it's not a high bar to say everybody is a sinner by nature.
I'm with you. Sinner by nature dodges the question of fundamental goodness, fundamental badness. But I'm agreeing with everything you said. And you're right that for Augustine, sin is a deprivation. It's the absence of something. So it is the abuse of the free will. Anyone else over here? Are we? Well, I wouldn't want to have to do this, but just for the sake of argument, I guess I would say,
or is it fundamentally solid, or is it fundamentally gas? You know, so depending on what you mean by fundamental as opposed to where I find it one way or the other, it's fundamental.
Yeah, I appreciate there are nuances for sure. I also know that we like wiggle room. I know different times I've had my students do surveys and it's a 5-point Likert scale and somehow I get a 3.5 from somebody. No, there are 5 points on this scale. So to pin you down a little bit, right there is morally neutral, fundamentally. Fifty percent. 50-50. And now we're not talking about acts. We're talking about dispositions and orientations. We're talking about nature at this point, not acts. And I'm with you. I think a case could be made for both, and both still be a Christian position. But it does change things. Interestingly enough, I find that people who operate with the people are fundamentally good disposition, those are harder folks to share the gospel with. But that doesn't mean that our alternative should be, let's make everyone hate themselves just so they can hear the gospel more clearly. So that over 50% of the person is bad, or over 50% of the person is good. So let's go with that distinction. Over 50, not that there's always a mixture, but over 50% is bad. You have to vote or you get ejected from class. Everyone wants to want to vote now. Get me out of here. Over 50% good. Let's start there. Over 50% good. Fundamentally, at our nature, at our core of human beings, let's run with adults at this point. That's a good question. Because it's nuanced, isn't it? I mean, right. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Whatever effect there has been as a result of Adam and Eve, apart from Christ.
So, I like in Genesis, God looks at what he's made and says, he gets a man, and he says, he doesn't just say good, very good. I mean, that, something about that, to me, has to last, has to stick around. So, that's where I am a part of the Genesis.
A lot of foolish choices. Yes, those are forcing.
Nobody does.
You're forcing me to believe something I don't choose to believe. So, well, I can't make that choice. But as we were having the discussion, the thing that was in my mind was an illustration I used for years. To put that up there, I thought perhaps that was the illustration. And my illustration had to do with making good choices in elementary school counseling. Is we're born here, and over here is complete darkness and evil, and over here is complete light and good, all right? We're born here, facing this way, and so we make choices, and those choices move us this way or this way, and I guess we go back and forth until we get on the track, one way or the other.
Most of us, like I said, are going to be semi-Augustinian or semi-Pelagian somewhere in this area. And arguments can be made. Both. I mean, why is it that we're shocked when we hear of three murders in Harrisburg? If everyone outside of Christ is just a terrible human being with nothing of value, why does that shock us? It should shock us that there's anything good in the world, actually. But yet, why on the other side, it's like, how does a person who's clearly psychologically damaged at the least rise to power in the most educated, the most cultured society in Europe in the middle of the 1900s, and convince enough people that murdering 6 million Jews never mind other Romanians and Gypsies and political prisoners, that that's a good idea. And the world eventually says, never, never, never again. And how long was it till we had Pol Pot? How long was it till we had the Khmer Rouge? How long was it till we had, we never really talked about Stalin. Never, never again, but give us a few years and we'll be at it again. The Rwandan genocide. The Rwandan genocide lasted about 9 months, killed about 1 million people. A lot fewer than Nazi Germany, but Hitler had about a decade, not quite, but about a decade to do the damage. The Rwandan genocide was 9 months. So the intensity actually was greater in Rwanda than it was in Nazi Germany. That's been in my lifetime. That's been in, what, 30 years? The last 30, 20, 30 years. But we said never, never again. So on the one hand, why isn't we don't see more, you know, but why isn't we seeing it at all? Why are these things happening? It's just this weird mix of who we are. This illustration somewhat reluctantly. Last night, Marge and I chose to watch a documentary made by the man who made the video Nefarious about human trafficking. And he had a plan of what he was going to do for the next documentary. It didn't turn out quite the way he thought. I'm not even sure if I want to recommend the documentary because it exposes you to so much that I'm not sure everyone should see it or could handle watching it. But what he did was to go to spring break. And he showed up close what was happening at spring break in Cancun and in Florida and in half a dozen other places. And it was just an orgy. I mean, it just depicted an orgy. And there were acts of sexual violence. We talk about the Me Too movement. That's nuts. I mean, everybody's involved in all kinds of behavior that is just unbelievable almost. In the course of that orgiastic weekend or time, there was a rape on the beach where several individuals raped one individual who was unconscious. And on the news media, everywhere they were asking that question you just asked, how could these people walk by? How come nobody intervened? Well, it wasn't that different from anything else that was going on the beach at the same time. There were hundreds of situations like that going on at the same time. It's just that she happened to be unconscious. Walking by, you even though she's unconscious. It's the world we live in. It's the degradation of a culture. And there had to, at some level, be a degradation of a culture for anyone to believe it's okay to kill millions of people. So it's the same idea. It's just a little different. And so, you know, people argue vociferously that prostitution should be legalized because it's a choice. Little do I know. I'm not trying to say that it's inexplicable how much of it, but there are 1922 academics, university professors from two different German universities, came together and wrote a book, and the thrust of it was a phrase in German that came from the Leibniz virtues of the life unworthy of life. And they were making the case of why those who were physically disabled and mentally disabled were drain on society's resources, and it was actually a moral good to dispose of them. A moral good. Because it was life that was truly unworthy of being lived. It's 1920. Yeah, well, and it is, yeah, for sure. But it is the groundwork that all you have to do now is make the case that the Jews fit into that category. If you buy that as a principle, I can now make the case that the Jews are in that category. So what do? You take away their rights to vote, rights to have businesses, rights to be in public parks, rights to meet. You do that, all of a sudden they're now second class. These are lives that are worthy of living. They're drains on our resources. So I'm not trying to say that we don't know how to get there. We do know how to get there. So it is a conundrum, isn't it? Because, we are amazingly wonderful, beautiful, capable of wonderful things, and we are monsters. And it can go either way.
I'm wondering about Pelagianism, if it creates space to understand how Jesus could live a perfect life. It seems like under the other view, the Catholic theologians needed to come up with a way that Mary, was it, you were saying that Mary was conceived immaculately, and that circumvented this problem that Augustine might have foreseen with his theology. Does Pelagianism help us understand Christ?
It does, in a unique way. And for those of us who have died in the war, have been trained in the kind of substitutionary atonement thinking, it's not going to be sufficient, but there's still something there. So Pelagian was a Christian, would have called the name of Christ. Where he would have found Christ to be beneficial, what Christ offers to us then is this wonderful moral example of how a life is supposed to be lived unto God. Now, for a lot of us, it's like, it feels like that cross should have been a little more than just math. I would agree with that sentiment. But that we have, before we go there, we have to make sure we understand there is still significant power in that. If I told you the Black Hawk Down stuff, I get interested in certain things. When the helicopters in Mogadishu went down, I ended up reading a lot about that, mainly because one of the Delta Force operators that was killed in that operation was a guy on my football team in high school. One of the youngest men to ever be brought into Special Forces was a medic with them. So because of that connection, I'm very, very interested in this. And part of the story, Mike Durant is the pilot of the second helicopter that eventually goes down. He's there to provide air support for the first helicopter that had gone down. And he gets there. He's almost immediately shot down. He's the only one of his crew that survives. In the Black Hawk helicopter, the seats, the pilot seats, are designed, they're engineered to withstand 7 Gs. That is 7 times the force of gravity on your body. He hits with such force that the front of his seat breaks both of his femurs right in half. That's how hard the helicopter hit when his helicopter went down. The largest bone in the human body broke right in half just on the front edge of his seat that was supposed to be designed to. So he really just slammed him into the ground. He's down there now. This thing is just gone down the toilet immediately. Before long, 2 Delta snipers are asking for permission to go secure the site, basically to protect Mike Durant and his crew, which they don't know if any of them are alive or dead. It takes them 3 requests to get permission to go. And finally, the controller says, I can't tell you when reinforcement is coming. Do you understand what you're asking? And they asked the 3rd time then for permission to go. And they were shuttled in real quick on a quick helicopter. They were held down, and they were there. Of the 3 that were alive at that point, Mike Durant, the helicopter pilot, was the only one to survive. Those 2 young men, Randy Sugar and I can't remember their names, knew what they were doing when they went down there to protect Mike Durant. And yet they said it was worth it. Now here's what's interesting to me. Mike Durant went through a crisis after that
once he was arrested. He was kept alive because they realized pilots were valuable, and they were bargaining chips with the American government. It was the only reason he remained alive. Mike Durant went through a dark night where he was questioning whether his life was worthy of the sacrifice that people have made. That's moral example. That is the idea of, oh my goodness, someone would do that for me. Forget guilt or innocence, forgiveness, forget all that stuff. There's this beautiful picture of love being laid out for the sake of another, putting oneself completely at risk just so another can have another day. There is something to be said for moral example here in the government. Does it address our guilt before God? No, there's some deficiencies there. But it shouldn't just be dismissed as, well, that's an inadequate theory of atonement. Folks, they're all at some level inadequate. None of them can fully get their arms around what Jesus did on the cross. They all can get a piece of it. So Pelagius' view, he would still have a place for Christ. It would be as this idea of moral example. The beauty of this picture calls us to live lives like that. That was the idea. I don't think it will conclusively make someone do that, but I do think that kind of beauty does pull us in that direction. I mean, could Mike Durant's life ended up in the toilet? Yeah, but probably because he could have become an alcoholic and all kinds of things, all because of the trauma. But he becomes a very good, upstanding man, in large part because of this price that was paid for him at some level. So, do they have a place for Jesus? They do. It's not the way we normally think of Jesus, but it's what we call eventually called the moral example theory of atonement.
Can you talk about Pelagianism and kind of and why the church had a problem with it in the extreme? Can you kind of paint a picture of how you think the church would be different if we had adopted that and said there's always problems at the extreme, but this is going to be the main one thought instead of the other?
Hmm. That's interesting.
Like, what were they trying to address? Because they had to have a goal in order to put forward a thought process, and then it was shot down. But their goal wasn't to show that someone else could be like Jesus. That wasn't the intent.
Right. Yeah, I have to give that. That's one that would be like some time to ponder for me at least. At some level, I guess where I take some solace in what we look at the Catholic Church Pope saying you can't have communion, it sounds kind of serious, but what they're not doing, it would be one thing if they said no to him and they baptized Augustinianism at the same time, and they don't. They're simply essentially saying, "Oops, we found another ditch. This is out of bounds over here." They don't actually say you have to understand it how Augustine did. They're just saying, okay, we found the car in the ditch again. Okay, here's the guardrail, don't go over here anymore. That is a place where the current Roman Catholic Church would be closer to Pelagian than to Augustine.
Raised their hand to basically good, wouldn't have said, and had no sin.
Right. Yeah.
And so,
can we come back to that issue? It's worthy of some thought because it does affect how you orient yourself as you approach people. Is this person essentially bad that I have to somehow kind of be an instrument in turning them around? Or is this person essentially good, and I just have to help them understand it's nice that you're good, but this isn't actually about being good. So, Jesus doesn't come to go from, oh, I'm going to put you from here to over here. He goes, he takes you wherever you are, and makes you new, and puts you in his kingdom.
one of the problems, even with the understandings of faith that, you know, I grew up in the kind of church where the Billy Graham thing where because of sin there is this gap between God and human beings. I'm not saying there isn't, but when Jesus makes that bridge that we now can get across to God, what keeps me from bringing my sinful nature over there? See, this isn't just about jumping over a chasm. This is about him making love that was good. He's not interested in second chances. He's interested in new life. Brand new. And so this is where we are, figuring out we're going that way, how good, how bad. And God wants to say, you know what? At your worst, I want to be with you. At your worst, I want to be with you. And so it almost takes an eraser to both Augustine and Pelagius at the same time. Because he's after something much more profound. It's not just about scrubbing your nature clean, it's about giving your hidden nature. And I think that's where the Orthodox are onto something. It is union with Christ. It is being hid in him, being found in him. Those are some of the metaphors, I think, that will really help those who see themselves as good. We don't have to get them lost before we get them saved. We just have to help them understand your life would mean so much more, and so much more sense if you were living in Christ. That's the sermon I don't want to answer at all for you to say, but the rabbit trail will be from us into the woods sometimes. All right. That's a good place to stop. My plan was to spend most of our time on St. Patrick. He's essentially a contemporary of Augustine. You have the first thing you have on that sheet. I probably didn't make enough. If you want one, let me know. I'll send you an email. The first thing is from his confessions. I don't know what it is about these saints back then. They all write confessions. But that's from St. Patrick's confessions. The second part is what's called his breastplate prayer. It's real. I mean, if you're kind of, your spiritual journey is okay with written prayers, that's a good one. It covers just the, you know, prayers before me, behind me, upstairs, downstairs. It's just whatever. Christ is essentially what he's saying. He 89 born, very young age, 405 or something like that, gets kidnapped by Irish pirates, taken to Ireland, is there for years, eventually is allowed to leave. God says, you have to leave, and leaves. Eventually, towards the end of his life, 431, comes back to Ireland. From 431 to 461, the numbers are about 100 to 120,000 people were baptized by him. He plants 300 churches in Ireland. So just unreal. And supposedly, he gets more snakes in Ireland. Okay, well, look at that. We can come back to that if you have questions or if you want to read up about Patrick. My intention will be to start next week going back then to the just word theory with the Horton's getting back. So thanks for your time.